Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Heart Talk with Miss E, and happy National Foster Care Awareness Month. For those of you who know me, you know that this is one of my favorite months of the year because I get to celebrate that which is close to my heart year-round. And before I started doing Foster Pride Month, I was pretty much aware that most agencies or organizations that even acknowledge the month mostly acknowledge the caregivers and the foster parents and the social workers, but very few people really talked about those who lived the whole story day in and day out for sometimes years in a lifetime up until adulthood. So with Four Child's Heart, we started 25 years ago celebrating National Foster Pride. And this was the month because it's also close to graduation time, where we offered scholarships for those who were moving forward to go to college to further their education, or for those who wanted to take up some type of trade or certification, for those who were moving out on their own and transitioning into a new life. We wanted to support them, and that's always been a wonderful time. Over the past few years, probably about the past 3 to 4 years, we haven't had any ceremonies. However, the work has continued to be able to support and to mentor those who have passed through the system. This is also the month that we have acknowledged and given awards, and we had chosen our special honoree, Mr. Les Brown, who himself was a foster child and adoptee along with his twin brother. And we call that award the Les Brown Heart of Dreams and Tenacity Award. And, you know, his first book was about living your dreams. And we awarded young people who we saw and who we see are moving forward, who have a dream, who have a vision, and need the support to fulfill and make that dream become manifest. So if you haven't already, you can look back at some of our old podcasts and listen to some of those interviews. You can also take a look at our website, www.forachildsheart.org, and look at some of our past events where we have just had grand celebrations during this month of time. May happens to also be National Mental Health Awareness Month. And that's a topic that hasn't been as widely acknowledged and recognized, but I'm really glad to be able to combine the two, because as a mental health professional, I have devoted most of my time to dealing with some of the emotional issues of those who've gone through the system and trying to help those who are working with them to gain a better understanding of what's going on. And that has been my passion. As having been a social worker and also a foster parent, I realized that no one really understands until they've walked in those shoes. So tonight, our guest is someone who is quite acquainted with both symptoms, as I refer to them, and has an awesome testimony and testament and story about what she has gone through as a child. I had the opportunity of meeting her as a teen and reconnecting with her, I guess, about 5 years ago as an adult. And I am just glad to say I am so proud of her commitment, not only to her well-being, but that of others, and sharing her story and willing to help others to realize that they, too, can make it. Our guest tonight is Ms. Christina Renee Murphy. And Christina is currently employed with the Berkeley Mental Health, and I just moved my note and lost my place, but she works in the Berkeley Drop-In Center there, and she will tell you more about what she does. I had the opportunity last year of watching her serve and become a nominee and was finally elected to the Rent Board Commission of the Rent Board as a commissioner for the Berkeley City of Berkeley. And she is just an advocate. She's a go-getter. She's a doer. She's a talker and a doer. People say, don't tell me, just do it. Christina does both. So I'll introduce to you my guest, Ms. Christina Renee Murphy. Are you there, Christina?
Yes, thank you, and thank you for having me.
You're more than welcome.
And thank you, everyone,
thank you.
That's tuning in.
Yes, and as we speak, she is actually in the middle of a road trip as we speak. So she has taken off the highway on her way to Southern California to be a part of this interview. So I just want to thank you, and I don't want to delay any time. But tell us what your current position is in your employment and what it is that you do.
Okay, so as they say, my 9-to-5, well, my full-time job, I am a housing coordinator at the Berkeley Drop-In Center. I've been there almost 7 years. And what my position and what my duties will be is to provide supportive services around housing needs and challenges. Of course, we all know that housing challenges is not about just not having the money. It is a lot of other things that will hinder you, barriers that will keep you from receiving permanent sustainable housing. Discrimination, lack of affordable housing, it's just a number of things. And also, while working there, I've also became a peer specialist by helping not just consumers, but just people that have not had any diagnosis or that just still need services, supportive services. And I provide wraparound supportive services, if that's just an ID, counseling, money management, payee services. So at the agency I work at, we provide supportive services. And then I have the opportunity, and I'm very honored that the community has elected me as a rent board commissioner, as Ms. Evelyn has mentioned earlier, that my job is to make sure that the ordinances are followed and followed with no biases. And what that means is I live in Berkeley, California, and so in Berkeley, California, there's rent control. And there's also this thing called Costa-Hawkins. And when Costa-Hawkins came a while ago, if I'm not mistaken, 1990, 1991, it was like almost a good ideal because everyone, like homeowners, could get a fair return. Well, time has changed, and they need to reassess that because right now fair market is not $900 or $1,000 for a one-bedroom. Right now it is $1,800 to $2,000 to $2,500 for a studio. So my job is to help people navigate the system and find out how to become more empowered and independent and not rely on government programs.
Wow. Now, and with the cost, you know, of housing going up so much, we know that the two populations that we're addressing this evening are particularly hit, and often the homeless population tends to involve at a higher percentage, and I'm not one that really studies and is aware of a lot of statistics. I deal with just face-to-face, heart-to-heart people. But the statistics show that the homelessness, there's a large percentage of former foster youth or transitioning foster youth, and also within that population and exclusive of that population, people who are dealing with mental health or mental illness, mental health issues. Is that something that you've seen in your work?
Well, first in my work, what we do is I'm also part of a group called POCC, which stands for Pool of Consumer Champions. And what our mission is to advocate, to lead, and to empower. So we watch our language, so we don't really say illnesses anymore. We say challenges because a lot of us find out that it's just really our environment and really our lack of certain tools. And so when we come to agencies like the one I work at, where peers, it's a peer-ran agency. So that's what makes us so unique. We've been around over 27 years. And it's important to know where to go, like a one-stop kind of place, instead of being sent to all these different kind of areas. So at our location, we have all the departments that you can use and need to provide support around the lack of need, the lack of services.
Okay. And so when someone comes in and they complete, you know, application for services, do you find that many of the consumers have that the history of either of those situations as having come through the foster care system?
Okay. And then I believe the problem is they've been failed by the system. So what happens is when they come to me, either with a diagnosis already from way back, and they haven't seen anybody. So they're just like, I call them like they're just lingering, and I call it that they're failing, but they fell between the cracks, and the system has failed them as far as providing them supportive services around their mental health. So what my job is, before I even do the intake, I always find out who the person is first. And always find out what their needs are. Because when people come to you, they don't want to tell you their life story if you can't help them. So I always find out what their needs are, and then I help them with that. And then I do the 15-minute intake, which is for the city, and so that we can keep our funding. But I think it's most important for me that I'm in a position that, as being a former foster youth and coming from, at a young age, being in psychiatric hospitals, it's like if anybody can tell them how to navigate the system, it could be me. And so I'm just very grateful that I'm able to provide these supports, you know, without a college degree, you know. And it's really about using what you have to give back. And in participation like that, you get well. So I think it's great.
Wow. And I understand that you've also been nominated for an award that you will be receiving actually this weekend.
Yes. So tomorrow, on Saturday, I will be receiving an award that I was nominated for in Berkeley. It's the Mental Health Achievement Award for my services in the mental health field in the consumer category on May 6th. At 1 o'clock. So I'll be doing a quick turnaround straight from Southern California to go back to receive the award. And I'm honored.
Wow.
I'm honored because, you know, it's a lot going on. It's a lot of work that needs to be done out here in the community, and to be recognized is an honor, you know?
It is. And I am so proud of you and so pleased to see you working. And you, you know, are actually a product of For a Child's Heart. And it's like when I look at you and I see young people, I said, the children have now become the village. You know, we talk about the village taking care of a child, but the children, you as one of the children, have now become the village. And you are truly doing the heart work because your heart is all in it. And I was so proud when I was, you know, in the assembly and watching you speak, you know, amongst all these, you know, people who came with their proper etiquette and all of that. And you said, look, I'm just real. This is her. I'm just going to call it as I see it. And I said, that's my girl. And that's how I remember you as a teenager. So for our listening audience, tell us how you first entered the system, either which came first, mental health or foster care.
So when I think back, I think that the mental health services came first.
Okay.
When I was about 6 years old.
Okay. And what happened at that point?
And to be honest, it was like the most traumatizing part of my life, besides the reason why I even ended up in it. I ended up in the mental services, the mental health services, because I was sexually assaulted and abused as a child by my babysitter. And so when I ended up in the when I went to school, I told the teacher, and she told my parents that I told her I was pregnant, and that's how they found out. And instead of my parents believing me, because back in those days, it wasn't a such thing, and they didn't believe you. They always said it was your fault back in those days. They didn't have services for families back in the day. I'm 38 years old now. So back when I was 6 and 7 years old, they didn't have a lot of supportive services for families. They only had, like, take the child away kind of services. And so when you are a child that's not being heard, instead of continuing to tell people it happened, you start acting out. And you start acting out either violently or insubordinate or running away or, you know, hurt people. So, and then at that point, I ended up, they gave my parents a choice to either take me to a psychiatric ward in Memphis, Tennessee, or take all the kids. And I had, it was three of us in the family. I had a little brother and a little sister. And so they decided to let the system take me, because they felt like their hands was crossed. They didn't feel like they had any other choice, you know? And that's the great thing about today, is that we have so many grassroots movements, and so many, so much work we've done in these centuries and centuries, to where now there's a lot of alternatives and a lot of support for families and a lot of support for consumers, you know?
Mm-hmm. And for people to know how to assess them. And I'm sure your parents thought they were doing the best thing at the time, being just totally caught off guard and not knowing what to do or where to go. So your acting out was running away, being violent, being assaultive towards other children, and also, I guess, sexually acting out with children as well?
Right. So it wasn't really other children. It was like I would do stuff to my sister. Like I would tie her up. You know, I would, like, make her cry. You know, I would, like, I would do what my mom did to me. Like, she didn't know how to react to me. So she, you know, growing up in our family, my mom is African-American and Cherokee Indian, and my dad is Filipino and Black. And so back in them days growing up, my dad is military, and my mom was a housewife. So back in them days, there's no such thing as going to tell your business to a therapist or going taking no medication. They didn't believe in that. They believe you need a whooping and you'll be well. After you get a whooping, you'll be well. And I didn't get beat by my parents, and my parents wasn't on drugs. But I did get enough whoopings, and it wasn't enough to call that 1-800 number to get them in jail, but I did get whooping. Today they call it child abuse, but back in the days it wasn't called child abuse. It was called you chastising your kids.
So basically they didn't know how to handle you.
Right.
They didn't know how to resolve your behavioral issues. So they took you for mental health, and they hospitalized you at 7 years
right.
old. Okay.
Right.
And their intent then was to calm you down or stabilize you?
I think it was like, I'm not sure because it was so long ago, if it was called 5150 back in the days, because I think in the process of them not listening to me and believing me, I think I might have tried to kill myself at 6 years old. I might have took some pills. I remember sucking off the coating on Advil when I was a kid. I remember I used to like the way it tastes. So I wasn't sure if I really wanted to die at six, but I knew I used to take these pills. And so I think, I don't know if they called it 5150 back in the days, but I think they were trying to assess me and to see if I was okay. And I don't think my parents was aware I was taking pills, but when they found out, they probably told them, you know? So I'm not really sure. But yeah. But once I got there, then they put me on these medicine called Milarel.
Milarel, okay. So they felt that there was enough going on that that they felt that you had some type of psychological issues going on. And, you know, even as a clinician, you know, when people talk about the psychological issues, and that's why I focus so much on the heart, because when your heart is broken and it's torn to pieces because that trust has been betrayed as a child or as an adult or any phase in life, it tears your person apart, your soul apart, and then your mind starts to function differently. So as they put you on medication at the hospital, they sent you home, and...
Oh, no, I don't think I got sent home. I think they put me on medication, and then they did these... So before they did medication, they tried some other treatments. Like, they had, like, some other treatments they used to do back in the days, and they still do some of them still today, like shock treatment, and they might... if you, like... scream or punch, they feel like you're a threat to yourself or others, so they will take you, and mind you, I'm 7 years old, and they will take you and put you in, like, these restraints, like, on this white table, and they will strap you down, and they will close the door and turn the lights out, and you will stay in there until you stop screaming. And so sometimes I wouldn't stop screaming, so they would give me some, like, medicine, I don't know. And I think that's how they became where they found out, like, Milarel work. Because I think I was there for over 30 days. And so, like, Milarel work. And then they decided that they didn't want to restrain me no more. They just want to lock me in a padded room with the lights out.
Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah.
That's traumatic for an adult. I can't even imagine for a young child going through that, feeling like you're being punished and no one there to support you, to protect you. That was worse than being at home.
That's exactly what I just said, that was one of the most traumatized part of my life.
That was supposed to be helpful. And unfortunately, that's the way some children experience foster care, that what happens to them in foster care is more traumatic than what's happened in the home that they're removed from. Not all, but for some. And I know everyone's experience is different. So that was like at 7 years old, early childhood.
Right.
What was the next major event that you recall in your life?
And then I think like at 8, they were like going through a process for the court proceeding for the person that had a sexually assaulted me when I was my babysitter. They were about to file charges against him, right? But it was like snowing a lot. I remember it snowing a lot. And I remember going back and forth to court a lot. And I remember my family, like, I remember them getting tired. You know, and I remember them feeling like this was a depressing state to live in, like, you know, and I remember my grandmother, which is my mother's mother, rest in peace, Alice Cunningham, called my mom to come back home. So my mom and my dad, we all drove back to California.
Wow.
And
that's
we
where
stayed
they were
with her in Berkeley, California.
So as you know, the court issue never did come to any resolution, to your knowledge.
I'm not really sure what happened with the proceedings. I sure would like to know.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So you came back to California, you and your mom and your siblings and your dad, and you stayed with your paternal or maternal grandmother?
It was my mother's mother. And I was 12. We were 12, I remember. I was 12.
Okay. All right. So that was another adjustment for you.
Right, it was, because I remember the kids used to tease me and say I thought I was Caucasian because of the way I dressed, the way I danced, and the way I talked. And it was just so, it was interesting because I used to get bullied, you know?
Wow.
And so I would come home and take it out on my sister and brother. I would beat them up. And my mom couldn't handle it. And my dad worked all the time. And so you know, I got tired of the whoopings. I got blamed for everything they did. Some of it probably was my fault, but not all of it. Probably 60% mm-hmm. of it, but not all of it. And right, I used to run right. away as well. And then when the police come, I guess after you, back in them days, if you run away a certain amount of times, the system get involved. And so okay. they made that same kind of like with my mom. I either take all the kids or we just take her.
Wow.
And being that I already had a history from 6 years old, I was already the number one child to go.
Okay, so you had already been labeled.
Right. And so, and then after that, I ended up in the, it was called the emergency group home system, because it wasn't like set in stone foster care yet. I guess they put you through a 30-day, and then they find you a place for 6 months, and then they find you a place for a year, and then they find you a place. But I used to run away all the time. So they used to place me real far, like the Ain't Her Vegetable, like really far. And then the last place they sent me was Fairfield, and that's how I met Miss Pope. I think I was about 16.
About 15 or 16. And, you know, and as you share this, I recognize another glitch in the system, because the only thing that was shared with me at that time was, you know, basically that you were oppositional. No one had really given, passed on the complete history to better understand you of what was going on. But fortunately, there was enough trust developed in our working together that you would share what you were comfortable sharing of what you were going through at any given time. So that was your adolescence, was spent going in and out of homes. And approximately how many homes would you say that you were in, or placements, because not all of them were actually homes?
Wow, let's see. Probably about, I don't know, over 25. But let me say this, though. The last home that I went in when I was 13, it was in, like I was shifted around in Alameda County for a while. And then the last home I was in when I was 13 was called the Berkeley Academy. And at that time, when you are doing good, because remind you, when I left, when I was at the psychiatric hospital, I guess over the time they came up with a diagnosis that I had ADHD and that I had some post-traumatic stress traits.
Disorder.
And so with that, with that diagnosis at six, it followed me to when I was 12. And then when I was removed from the home at 12, I was placed at Berkeley Academy, and then when you do good at Berkeley Academy, which good means going to class, making your bed, and going to counseling and telling them whatever they want to hear, and taking your medicine that they tell you, and going on these little activities to Scandia, and just going like all that stuff that wasn't empowering me or helping me. And they moved me to a place in East Oakland. I'm not really sure what the name of it is, but I met this lady that was a counselor there, and her name was Wendy Lucero. And then Wendy Lucero told me that she didn't really like the system and that she was going to do whatever she had to do to change the system. Now, I'm 13 years old at this time, 12 or 13, and she became went back to school and became a social worker. And then when she became a social worker, she became my worker. And when she became my worker, I got moved to another house on Ashby for, like, independent people that are, like, getting better, where they could leave on their own. And so I was, like, 16 at this time. And I met her again because in between 14 and 16, they moved me to Fairfield. And that's how I met you, Ms. Polk. And then when I ran away from Fairfield, they moved me all the way to Sebastopol. And then I came back from Sebastopol, and they moved me to Berkeley. And then I found her again, Wendy Lucero, and that's when I found out she was a marriage therapist, MSC. And I was like, beautiful, because my insurance was Medi-Cal, Medicare, and she was able to give me counseling and services. And it was nice because in this system, it's all about trust, and it's about building mm-hmm. trust. And for us, as being abandoned and neglected, the first thing we look for is trust, and we look for people that really care. And so those are the two people. I met you and I met Wendy, and so those are like the foundations of the system. Don't have to look like this on both sides, and you can be part mm-hmm. of the change. So then after that, I moved into my own apartment when I was 17. It was funny because when I was at Berkeley Academy, I looked outside and I seen this guy that looked like my dad. And I went over to him and I asked him, "What's your name?" And he told me his name was Antonio Murphy. And I said, "My daddy named Christopher Murphy." And he said, "I have a long-lost sister." And I said, "I have a long-lost brother." And it was interesting because I could not believe it was like a movie. And then I found out who the rest of my family was on my dad's side, which is the Filipino and Black side of my family. And from then on, I never was in the system. And I stayed with my cousin, Roshan Martin, that taught me how to stand up for myself and taught me how to, like, just understand that my parents, it wasn't that they didn't love me at the time. It was that they thought that they were doing the best that they can do. And she loved mm-hmm. me. And then I found my own place. And I've been on my own ever since then.
Wow. Amazing. So looking over your journey, and I know that there's so many details you can't even discuss here that are going to be in your book, that you've entitled already, Prison at Your Own Free Will.
Yeah, Prisoner at Your Own Free Will.
Okay. So in that book, which will be published by Hard Talk Publications, you will tell more of the details of what happened throughout, you know, the twists and turns. But the one thing that is just so amazing to me about your life, the difficult, there, I can see where so many aspects of your life have been interwoven together for positive, for you to fulfill your purpose in life. Do you feel that?
Can you repeat that? I'm sorry, traffic is passing.
Okay. I said,
just the last part. I heard the first part.
Okay. I was saying, but can you see or feel where that even the difficult parts of your life, where strands have been woven together to allow you to be, fulfill your purpose in life?
Oh, yes. Yes, my purpose in life is to make sure that for every person that feel like a door is closed, I'm going to be there to show them. See, when I empower my clients and the community members that come into the agency I work in, it's not about teaching them how to work the system. It's teaching them how to let the system work for them. And if you qualify mm-hmm. for services, let the system work for you. Don't let the system play you and tell you what your life is supposed to be. You know, a lot of us mm-hmm. need medication, but a lot of us really appreciate the alternative methods, such as me. I like a lot of cognitive therapy and a lot of mentorship. I'm involved in a lot of motivational kind of grassroots movements, and, you know, that helps me stay well. But for the people that do take medication, I say, take your medication. Like, if that's what you need to stay well, take your medication. And if you someone that feel like you don't want to take your medication, please consult with your doctor, because that's what I did. I consulted with my doctor to wean me off, and it's been almost 5 years now since I've been on medication, and to wean me off so that I can get to a place where I took back the power and the control of my recovery, you know?
Did you ever feel, or did any of your professionals feel that you were at risk of danger by not taking your medication?
Oh, yes. I had so many misdiagnoses. I had to write so many letters to find new doctors. That's the thing. If you're seeing somebody and y'all not vibing and y'all not dancing, you need to go back to the front and ask them to change you to a new doctor and tell them what kind of, like, characteristics you are. Because for me, I had to let them know I needed somebody that was compassionate, somebody that was going to listen to me and not just pull out a clipboard. So, yes, they were like, oh, well, you're in denial. This is the reason why this is happening. It's the reason why this is happening. And I was like, no, the reason is you're not listening to me. The reason is you're judging me from how I look on the outside or just my current situation. And so they're trying to empower me to be able to deal with life on life terms. Like, life don't stop just because we're born or inherited certain mental health challenges. That some of us don't even have a mental health challenge. It's the habits we picked up from our parents, such as OCD, you know? Some of those habits I have around cleaning up came from my mama because she was a clean freak. She loved having her house clean. So, but when you see the wrong doctor, they might tell you, you have some OCD issues. You got some problems, you know? You clean it too many times, you got a problem. Well, make sure the doctor you're seeing y'all vibing.
As a clinician, is that the thing that I hate is that, and it was what happened with my foster son, every behavior that he displayed was pathologized. You know, he had this and had that. It's like he's just a kid. And so in my thinking, I was feeling that, okay, well, he's just being given a more severe diagnosis to qualify him for a higher level of care, which means a higher level of payment to the program that he's in, and then by the time he's an adult, it's like, okay, well, whatever, and then gets passed on to another system. And that was very, very frustrating to me. So as a licensed therapist, I was always hesitant, and have been, to put particular labels, which is really what a diagnosis is, for a child on them, but to look and see what behaviors can be considered to be a strength that they have and to channel that into something positive. And I think the only time it should be considered to be pathological is if it's bringing harm to that child or to that person. And so that's a real big issue for me. And I think probably why my work with young people is probably would not be considered to be as quote unquote traditional, or what's the word? There's a C word for it. But it's so important that when you said that you have to meet the client, you have to find out what they need and who they are. And the other part is trusting that what they need is what they tell you they need. Most people say, well, no, that's what you need. What you need is this. And then there becomes what is labeled as the resistance, because it's like, how are you going to tell me what I need? I'm so glad that you were able to speak up for and to ask for what it is that you needed. What was the most helpful thing for you in both being a foster child, going through care, and as well as being a client in the mental health system? What was most helpful to you?
The most helpful thing was to be wraparound services, like from the people I told you that was working out, my therapist, my mentors. I got involved in school. I took some classes to learn about what this disorder was that they say I had.
Okay. And so did your diagnosis change after you became an adult?
Actually, I haven't had a new assessment since I was 17 years old. I need to be rediagnosed. I keep telling them that I need a rediagnosement, but they think that I have bipolar, and they say that I have acute post-traumatic stress.
Okay.
Because I've experienced so many traumatic episodes.
Right. And even as we speak, you've just gone through something that's traumatic. But I admire, one, your honesty in saying, you know what, I need some help right now. I don't know if I'm handling how well I'm handling this, or I don't know if I'm going to be able to handle this as well. And you're reaching out for help. You know, and I love basically, you know, your line is, for the most part, there's no shame in my game. It's whatever it takes to be the best person I can be, that's what I'm going to do. And I think that is one of your greatest strengths, because some people hide out because their shame and some of the things that they're experiencing, and they don't want anyone to think negatively of them. And so having a good support system wrap around, and sometimes people will not go to seek professional services because they feel like they should be able to get that in their within their family or within their community. And it's just a different type of community, a more structured community, would you say?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
I would say
yeah.
it's just a different type of community. And I just think that I really appreciate all the work that people are putting in, all the consumers, and all the work around alternative services because,
mm-hmm.
like I was saying, the treatments don't always, the treatment plans don't always work for everyone. It's not a cookie cut
mm-hmm.
kind of situation. Everybody's
mm-hmm.
individual.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so in your plan, you had the wraparound services, which includes your individual therapy. You also did groups, right?
I've been involved in support groups. Involved in Alcohol Anonymous groups. It's been over 4 years since I've had a drink. And so I think also we have to remember that when we are when we are involving ourselves in alternate things such as alcohol or drugs, I wasn't addicted to drugs, but I did drink alcohol, and with alcohol and medication mixed together, it don't work. And so
okay.
I have that kind of got me into the criminal system. And so it was important that I stopped drinking, you know? And
mm-hmm.
and so we have to remember that when we are in treatment, we cannot involve ourselves with things that alternate our mood when we are on mood stabilizers.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit, because when we, you know, when you did your profile, you indicated that you were doing some more self-destructive things that affected your work, your relationships. Can you share just a little bit with us about how those aspects of your life were impacted?
So my relationships was impacted with my, like, significant other. I'm on my second marriage. My life has been impacted by my relationships with my family, work, schooling, like, it hindered me from taking these chances.
Okay. So it affected your confidence, it affected your ability to communicate effectively with
right.
people. And
well, I didn't really realize I didn't know how to communicate. I thought
okay.
I was communicating.
Mhm. But what were you doing instead?
They called it acting out. That's what the system called it. The system called it acting
mm-hmm.
out.
Mhm. Okay. So give me just a scenario. You know, something that maybe you recall that was done, and you look back and say, I'll never do that again. I know better.
Drink and drive. You could kill somebody.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I will never try to kill myself. What good would I be if I wasn't here? How am I going to help change the system?
Okay. So you did have an episode of suicidal tendencies.
Right.
Mhm. Okay. I like how you share about taking responsibility for your choices, because at one point your employment was that of a bartender. Hello?
Can you hear me?
I couldn't then. And I
can you hear me now?
In the background.
Yes,
let's see,
because I'm standing somewhere where I can make sure I get service.
Okay. I'm hearing something like
okay.
a radio or something in the background.
Yeah, I'm sitting next to a car. That's where my service is picking up. Okay, so
okay.
I just rolled up the window. I had it like out the window, making sure I pick up service because I do whatever it takes to get the word out.
Yes, you do. No excuses. Yeah, and I want to talk about that a little bit before we end. We have about 15 minutes. But about the time that when your employment was that of a bartender.
Yes, I was a bartender from 21 all the way up into 35.
And so that was fun. You talking about that.
It was fun, but it got me in trouble because when you're a bartender, you're around alcohol, so you're drinking. You're not really dealing with the issues that come up. Instead, you're suppressing them with the alcohol, and then you're hanging out with people, and then people with the fake love, and then you're in relationships that's not real. And, you know, it's just, it was, so at some point I decided that I didn't want to be around alcohol. And I think that point was when I entered the criminal system and I ended up getting three DUIs. And three DUIs kind of equal out to almost like each DUI is almost $8,000 each because you got to pay restitution. You got to pay to go to these classes. And I paid like $250 a class to sit in it for 18 months. Most people, they get DUIs, they get like 6 months treatment. I got 18 months each DUI, 18 months.
Wow.
And I didn't start messing up in the criminal side until I turned 18, you know.
Okay.
And so I wasn't familiar with it, so I was making all the wrong mistakes to get caught. I wasn't a real criminal. I didn't know what I was doing. And I would get caught drinking and driving. I can't say I was drunk, but I can admit that I was under the influence, and it's not okay. You can kill somebody. It's not okay. You know, it's almost on the same level as texting and driving. It's not okay.
And so, 'cause you're not fully present.
Right. And
but
so after that, I learned that it ruined my driver's record. And I was like, I can't get a driver's job. So I went back to school, to Western Career College, and said, okay, I want to help people. My grandmother was a nurse. Most of the women in my family are nurses or housewives, and all the men are military. So I said, I'm going to go to school to be a medical assistant. I went to Western Career College. I graduated from Western Career College about in 2008. I worked up at the Tang Center, which is up across the street from Cal and Berkeley, Bancroft in Berkeley. I did that for about 2 months. I made good money. Hello?
I'm listening.
Hello? I made really good money, but every time I stuck a needle in someone and blood came, I would pass out. So the supervisor said, I think you need to find another career. And then after that, I went back to school at Berkeley City College and took up social service paraprofession. It was a 2-year certificate of completion program, and then you go into the next part of it. In that, I volunteered because in the program you have to give hours to your community. So I volunteered 3,800 hours at the South Berkeley Senior Center, and I thank Ms. Faye Cone for giving me a chance to work there. So she let me volunteer for 3,800 hours. I went there Monday through Friday from like 3 to 5. And I did that for a while, and then I went to the Berkeley Drop-In Center, and I, like, cooked, and I cooked for 75 people every Friday.
Wow.
And in that, I found that a lot of people didn't even have jobs because they didn't even know that you needed a resume. And they didn't know that a simple resume, a lot of these employers are looking for one-page resumes. And so they're afraid. So when I found that out, I started to help people with this app called, what was it called? It was called Resume Wizard. And you type in a few words on the kind of work you did, and it creates the resume for you. And I found 38 adults, men and women, from the ages of like 21 all the way up to the age of 65, jobs. And it's one thing to find a job for a person, but it's another thing to really assess the person and find out what kind of job. So that was kind of a challenge a little bit. But I found 38 people jobs. So now these are people that's never paid taxes. Now they're paying taxes. Now they feel a part of something. They're getting up, getting dressed. Now they're back participating in being, living like a sustainable citizen, right? And so the supervisor, Mr. Emmett Hudson, which has retired after working at the Berkeley Drop-In Center for over 25 years, he said that he's seen a light in me. And he said, I want you to be our housing assistant. And I told him,
wow.
I don't really know nothing about housing. And he asked me about some things I've been through in my life, and he said, well, you have the life experience, and we hire here for life experiences. This is a peer-ran agency. Started off as a housing assistant about 7 years ago, and it was interesting because when you are new and you have a lot of energy like I do, and all you want to do is give back and help, people around you are not always welcoming to that, because what that does is that changes the pattern of how they work, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And so at the beginning, it was hard. I was on SSI. I was only making $666 a month. I was surviving. I don't know how. That's why I'm here, to change, like, the minds around a living wage, you know, because it's not about low income. It's not about getting minimum wage. It's about a living wage. In that, Ms. Sandra taught me some stuff, and the rest I just ran with and learned by getting out in the community, talking to people. We call it, at this program I'm a part of, Urban Habitat, we call it power mapping. I started to power map, and in power mapping, you learn who make the decisions. You learn who are the people that need to be in your circle to accomplish this goal, which is changing the stinking thinking around the way consumers get well, right?
Mm-hmm.
So then I start getting involved, and thank you to Chris Worthington, City Council Member of Berkeley, Chris Worthington, and Max Anderson encouraging me, and Chris Worthington appointing me as an alternate to 5 different commissions in Berkeley. So, like, for a moment, I was a police review commissioner, you know, and right there, my duty was to hear from the community, and, you know, we vote on hearings and things, right? But once they found a replacement or someone to fill that position full time, I became a sub. So I'm just an alternate, right? But with that being said, that puts me on a different side of the table, which is not a bad thing. It's a great thing, because it put me on a side of the table to where I can come out in the community and get testimony on the misbehaving or the unfair, impartial treatment that's happening with our Berkeley Police Department. And being that I'm already from that community and live in the community, people trust me to tell me, because they know that the people on the other side of the table trust me and listen to me too. So it's really important that we're involved as consumers.
So you have relationship and credibility on both sides. And people might hear, you know, I'm you know, commissioner on this board and this something in this committee. They hear titles, but the thing I think is really important to realize, if you have a gift, whatever it is, there to not be intimidated by titles, because what you know, you have something that no one else there has. And when people don't have the diplomas, you know, or the degrees, or whatever behind their names, people are intimidated. So what would you say to people who are doing a great work and want to make a difference but feel like they have nothing to offer?
So like 2 years ago, I've also became a member of a group called Friends of Adeline, which is the street that I work on at the Berkeley Drop-In Center. And Adeline is a very, like, historic kind of, like, it's called South, it's considered South Berkeley, and a lot of minorities lived in that neighborhood before the all this displacement happened, right? And so the agency I work at also used to be the Panthers Free Health Center and the Free Clinic back in the days. So there's a lot of history there, but with the turnaround and some of the city council back in the days, back in like 2016, they wasn't as progressive as we needed for our community. And a lot of decisions was made that affected a large part of our community. And I always tell people, you don't realize it's a crisis until the crisis becomes yours. And so the people that were at the table were making decisions on items and new programs and things that they didn't even use or need ever, like ever would need. So to cut funding on these certain programs was just of a right of a little check mark of a pen. It wasn't to their heart and knew because they didn't know anybody in their circle. They're like privileged, so they don't really know. And so in that, I learned that we developed a group called Friends of Adeline 2 years ago where we meet every other Monday. We started out with about 25 of us, and now it's about 550 of us. And what we do we fight. We're like advocates. And what we do is we go around and make sure that the community benefits for whatever plans are being generated in our city. And when it don't, we make noise. And we make not just noise that is that is not transformative. We make noise that's transformative, you know, and we're very transparent about it. And we make the new developers, and I'm so grateful that we have these new 3 to 4 new elected city council members, Sophie Hahn and Kate Harrison, and we have our mayor Jesse Arrogant. They think progressive, and they also think about our city on how we can get it back the way it was as far as functioning. It takes everybody for us to be a community. It takes low income, high income, medium income. It takes privilege. It takes all of us. But if it gets to a point where we're making decisions and we're leaving people out. And for sure, I have to give major props up to Berkeley, because Berkeley does a lot around mental health. You know, besides the mental health system, Alameda County mental health system, Berkeley is one of the only cities that have a separate mental health service. And it's really important to know that, and to know that, to understand the community that you serve. And so if you have an agency that you created, it shouldn't take a rocket scientist to understand that our wraparound service is to support these people. And when we get support people like us and me and you, and if we get to a point where we say, well, I don't have a mental health challenge, lose your housing, lose your job, lose your husband, lose your partner, lose your wife, like lose one of your kids, or like get the wrong medication, or get the wrong diagnosis, or get the wrong doctor, and you're going to have some triggers of some mental health challenges.
That's right.
And according to the market rate right now, we're all a paycheck away from being homeless.
Hello.
You know, right now we're choosing between eating and paying our rent.
Mm-hmm.
And until we change our leaders at the table, the people that make the decisions, the decision makers, until we change their mindset around creating, empowering the community, we're going to continue to shift out this funding to these pilot programs that are not going to provide the level of service that the programs have been around for years and years and years been providing, such as the Berkeley Drop-In Center, Inner City Services. Inner City Services provide employment training. The only one that's been around, I remember when I dropped out of high school, when I was like, I was like 15 years old, I dropped out of high school. I walked into Inner City Services, Mr. Mansour, the president of the Berkeley chapter, NWACP. He told me that I can enroll in his program for the adult high school program, and I can get my high school diploma. I enrolled in that program, and I got my high school diploma through that program, and I found jobs through that program, and I got computer training through that program. And so it's important to remember, these are foundations I'm telling us about right now.
So it's about time to wrap up, and I hear you're getting a cough, and I want you to get back on the highway so it won't be too much nighttime while you're driving.
Yeah, it's a lot of pollen. It's a lot of pollen.
Yeah.
It's a lot of pollen.
A lot of information about being aware of resources and how to get involved. What would you say to someone that says, I would love to get involved, But I'm trying to get myself together before I can. I got to be help to myself before I can help anybody else. What would you say?
So I would say you are your own expert. You know how much you can take. And if you don't know, there's services and there's agencies, like I was saying, the Berkeley Drop-In Center. And under our umbrella, we have other programs too, like tenants support and reach out and reaching across and Best Now. And Best Now do peer specialist training. And so you can reach out to these programs, these nonprofit programs that are ran by peers so that they can help you navigate. You know, sometimes when it's in our head, it's so much. But when you come see someone that's been there and made it through, not a victim but a survivor, we make it through, it becomes just a number list of to-dos. And as the week or days or month or year go by, you just cross them out. You just cross it out as you go. And if you can't do it on your own, don't worry. You have programs, like I said, the Berkeley Drop-In Center, that will love to show you how we did it. And if our plan and our if don't work, we will help you figure out how your plan can work. Because it's not really about you being messed up. It's about the environment or the system being messed up. So we want to help you and show you, you know. And you can ease into it by getting involved with grassroots movements such as Pool of Consumer Champions, POCC. You know, you can start there, and they have so many different committees that you could just be involved and not have to say anything until you feel comfortable. Like I said, their mission is, and their mission statement is, we are who we serve, nothing about us without us, and that's what we really believe. Wow. And it's over 1,400 of us.
Wow. And I'm so glad that you are in an area where these things are available and you're making sure that they stay available. So many people are in areas, not only just here in the Bay Area, but in the state of California and nationwide. And I'm sure there will be people listening to this who may want to get involved or figure out how to start their own grassroots organization. So I want to extend an invitation for if anyone would be interested in having like a mastermind chat via phone with Christina, perhaps one Saturday morning, to really sort of write down and set some goals and guidelines to get started. You know, one of my favorite quotes by one of my motivational gurus, it says, you don't have to be great to get started, but you got to get started to become great. And my quote is, heal your heart, then follow it. So a lot of times we have thoughts and ideas about where we can go, the things that could be done, and we feel like, well, it can't be me. Yes, it can be you. But when we start to heal those parts of ourselves that need to be brought to whole and we start to see, it automatically comes. I'm almost guaranteed that most people who are doing great things didn't necessarily start off saying, I'm going to do great things. But as things started happening, they say, this is great. This is some things that are happening, and they find their passion, as Christina has. So I am just so excited. I'm looking forward to working with you and some other aspects of developing For a Child's Heart and perhaps even taking it further than it is. And I just want to thank you for giving credit where credit is due for people who've helped you along the path. I thank you just for acknowledging me and reminding me, you know, of the things that I never thought were such big things, and you said how valuable they were to you. And, you know, sometimes it's just that keeps one another going and saying, you know, okay, I'm going to continue to do what I'm doing, and I know I can do more, and it's not too big because I'm not in it alone. So I'm just very excited to have you now being a part of the village. And I love you. I'm proud of you. And you know you have my full support in anything that you set to do. And, you know, I also speak up when I don't think something is going too cool, too.
And that's the part I appreciate about you, because you need people in your circle that's going to keep it real with you and tell you, that don't sound right. Now let's sit down and figure this out. But what I would like to say is I want to thank you for this opportunity again. And I want to also thank the people that have tuned in. And if you have any questions, please reach out and let me know, because it's not a secret. And a lot of times we don't know because we feel alone, or we don't feel we could do it because we don't have these certain degrees. Well, when you have other people on your team, that is your experience, and that are your degrees.
Right.
And your life experiences outdo the book sometimes. And so I just want you to know that it's not my quote, but I've adopted it. Do whatever it takes in your wellness recovery, because you're worth it. And
right.
If no one else told you, I love you, and this is why I do what I do every day, and this is what gives me the empowerment, is to keep going through all the trials and tribulations I go through. So I just want to thank everybody again, and have a blessed day, and just know that recovery is possible.
Yes, it is. And thank you so much, Christina. And if you want to reach out, send us an email at heart@forachildsheart.org. That's H-E-A-R-T at forachildsheart.org. You can find us on Facebook, For a Child's Heart. There is me, talk to Miss E, talk to me, the Heart Lady, on Facebook. And thank you so much. Please leave us your feedback, whether it's on Facebook, whether it's on Twitter, whether it's on Blog Talk. Let us know how this conversation has impacted you, and if there's anything else that we can do that can help you be well on your path to recovery, as well as following your heart. So this is Miss E saying, heal your heart and follow it, and be open that you can always, and know that you can always talk to me. Take care. God bless. Have a good evening, and be safe, Christina.
Thank you. God bless.
All right. Good night, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Heavenly Mother.